Tova to all of you. According to my reckoning, this is my 28th High Holy Day season at Temple Israel. It's my 37th since my ordination as a rabbi. And almost every year that I can remember, I've spoken about Israel. When I do so, I never expect everyone to agree with me. I often don't even agree with myself. For those who look forward to my remarks about our people's nation state, you won't be disappointed. For those who would prefer I speak about something else, anything else, you will only be partially satisfied. I confess that for me, conceiving, writing, and delivering sermons on Israel is difficult and gut-wrenching, and I'm afraid that this year is no exception. Some rabbis regard Israel as a discrete topic that has nothing to do with their congregants, and that there are other more pressing issues of the day, and so they don't discuss it. Other rabbis realize that Israel raises such strong emotions for their communities that they avoid the subject altogether because they don't want to upset anyone. Please know that I don't enjoy upsetting people either, but on the High Holy Days, that's what we're supposed to do as Jews, to become upset with aspects of our lives and the world, and especially the Jewish world. Tradition calls upon us to confront our most difficult challenges on this day. If we're not upset, then we're not in line with the purpose of this season. The primary theme of my remarks today concerns the new American civil rights movement called Black Lives Matter, otherwise known as BLM. And I want to focus on two points: the Black Lives Matter civil rights agenda, and its views on Israel. I'm drawn to speak about this today because though Black Lives Matter was formed as a movement 3 years ago after the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, in early August of this summer, 70 African American organizations published the Movement for Black Lives Matter platform, a 40,000-word document representing thousands of African Americans across the country who had come together to articulate a common vision and agenda. I'm curious, how many of you have read the entire document? Anybody? It's online. You can read it. I've read it twice. This platform does not necessarily, however, represent all African Americans, and that needs to be understood. Nor do all those who have signed on to it agree with everything in it. The African American community is no more monolithic than is the American Jewish community, but more about that later. The name of the movement, Black Lives Matter, however, according to the veteran civil rights activist Ruby Sales, has always been the cry of African Americans since enslavement, and as a response in a society in which black lives were property and didn't matter. The specific platform of this movement is a crushing indictment of American white society and institutions. It condemns racism, overt and covert, in healthcare, police and criminal justice, education, employment, income disparity, banking, business, and housing. It describes the systemic range of injustices committed in this country, not only against people of color, but also against women, the LGBTQ community, and the poor. It represents more than 40 policy recommendations, including an overhaul of our criminal justice system and prisons, the decriminalization of black youth, opposition to the death penalty, reparations for slavery to the African American community, specifically in the areas of healthcare and higher education. The platform shines a light on what so many African Americans experience every day in America. Black children, women, and men can do everything right and still get shot in the streets for no reason. Nothing, not education and not a good job, protects blacks from beatings, arrests, and in some cases, death. It says that disparities in the treatment of whites and blacks exist everywhere. African Americans are profiled, followed around in department stores, stopped by police in their cars at a rate 5 times as frequently as whites. It's true that many of us in this community, especially those of us who don't have children of color, don't know what it's like to be parents who are terrified that their children will be beaten or shot when they leave the house each morning for school. Though the LAPD and other police departments around the country, and I'm thinking particularly of Miami and Dallas, have made great strides to diversify their forces, increase community policing, sensitize their officers to engage with all people as people, and exercise restraint, still peoples of color are more vulnerable than whites. Did you know that 11.1% of the American Jewish community is Jews of color, including Asian, Latino, and blacks? And this doesn't count Mizrahim and Sephardim, who are Jews from Asia and the Arab world, who are darker in skin, who constitute 20% of the American Jewish community. That's 31%, one could say, are people of color in the American Jewish community. Many in our community are married to people of color as well. In a word, people of color are us, and we are them, and we need each other. Of course, America has come a long way since the 1965 Civil Rights Act. We've elected our first African-American president. Far more African-Americans vote today than did 50 years ago. Since the 2012 elections, when many states tried to restrict voter registration, targeting people of color, the courts struck them down, not only because there's virtually no evidence of the fraud that those states claim to be addressing, but because the courts recognized those efforts as voter suppression based in racism and targeting of minority communities. The effort to restrict voting despite court victories continues in many places. The Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism through the Nitzavim Project is in partnership with the NAACP, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under Law, and the PICO National Network to protect the right to vote this election year. We at Temple Israel are taking part locally in partnership with the Blessed Sacrament Church in Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard. By all historic measures, contrary to the claims of one presidential candidate, our cities are safer than they've ever been. Though some cities around the country have suffered an increase in the murder rate and crime rate, in most places that rate is down. The state of the African American community is not on the verge of the apocalypse. There are more middle and upper middle class African Americans and are more represented in the professions, business, the arts, entertainment, politics, government, and diplomacy than at any time in American history, despite the stubborn scourge of racism. Nevertheless, there are still so many blacks locked into poverty, estimated at around 25% of the African American community, and under siege by police. The BLM platform takes the position that there continues to be persistent and institutionalized racism in our country. The platform is a radical and revolutionary document that likely can't be instituted as it is, nor should it. After reading it, I turned to a distinguished longtime legislator to ask what he thought of the platform's policy recommendations. He told me that there are many suggestions that could move our country forward. As a liberal Jew since childhood, who grew up supporting the civil rights movement and remembers well the Freedom Riders, Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, the murder of the 3 civil rights workers, 2 of whom were Jews, the preponderance of Reform rabbis and Jews in the civil rights movement, including my childhood rabbis, and so many other events from the early and mid-1960s. I sympathize with the frustration African Americans feel, and I identify with their hopes. I'm proud of the American Reform Movement's role in the civil rights movement. In the early 1990s, Temple Israel was deeply engaged with a Black Baptist church in South Los Angeles before, during, and after the Rodney King verdict and rioting. And I'm proud that our TIOH community has sought consistently to educate and engage our youth and congregants about ways to address the social inequities in American life. Our social justice program, led by Rabbi Josie Hudson and our Vice President of Social Justice, Heidi Siegel, and our Social Justice Task Force, are renewing our synagogue's engagement with communities across lines of faith, race, religion, and class, and we welcome all of your involvement. Through our social justice platform that includes advocacy, action, and education, we at the Temple are focusing on core issues in today's civil rights movement, especially criminal justice reform. Following today's service, I urge you to visit our justice table in the courtyard and read in your High Holy Day brochure about ways you can become involved. The goal of our social justice work here is to help transform our nation that was built on the backs of slaves into one in which the godliness of everyone, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, religion, and national origin, is respected and cherished. Ours must be a Jewish social theology that has hindsight, insight, and foresight. It needs not be an eyesight, but a we sight, because we Jews ought to understand that whenever we fragment and separate ourselves into silos, our communal sight gets shattered. Now, having said all this, I confess how stunned and deeply upset I was to read the few sentences in the Black Lives Matter platform section called Invest Divest. There it says, the United States justifies and advances the global war on terror via its alliance with Israel, and is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people. Israel is an apartheid state. I'm going to read that again, because I was reading all of the rest of it, and then I got to this portion. The United States justifies and advances the global war on terror via its alliance with Israel, and is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people. Israel is an apartheid state. I understand that this movement has tried to link its struggle with other struggling peoples, but to charge Israel with genocide and apartheid? Not only are both characterizations false, they're slanderous of the state of Israel and the Jewish people as a whole. The so-called apartheid wall, which constitutes only 5% of its entire length, the other 95% is actually a fence, was built after the horrific terrorist attacks in 2002. I was in Jerusalem during March of that year, the worst month of violence in the Second Intifada. Bombs were exploding all over Jerusalem. I walked by the Moment Cafe in West Jerusalem only an hour before it was blown up, murdering and maiming dozens of young Israelis. The security fence was built for one reason and one reason alone, to stop terrorists from entering from the West Bank into Israel to kill Jews. The fence has admittedly caused problems for many Palestinians, including making their travel difficult, expanding Israel's territory inside the Green Line, separating some farmers from their fields, and boxing in some Palestinian homes. But the fence has saved Jewish lives, and thus is, in my view, a necessary evil. The designer and builder of the fence told 20 of us from Temple Israel a few years ago when he took us on a tour of it in the Jerusalem area that he hoped to be the one who takes down every link and every cement section when a two-state resolution of the conflict at last comes and there's peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Halavai. Israel is not an apartheid state. Though there are injustices perpetrated by the Israeli military administration in the occupied West Bank, I've spoken and written about these injustices for years. They include unwarranted humiliation of Palestinians, theft of Palestinian land designated for Jewish settlements, nightly military searches in people's homes, routine arrests of suspected terrorists, home demolition of families of terrorists, injuries and deaths of Palestinians. There's much blame to be shared in this quagmire by both Israel and the Palestinians. Abba Eben was right when he observed decades ago that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity in coming to a two states for two peoples end of conflict agreement, which is the only way Israel will remain democratic and Jewish, and the only way the Palestinians will gain sovereignty and their national dignity. This was the whole purpose of Shimon Peres's life, and I pray that with his death, we don't lose this possibility. 6 years ago, in an open letter to Bishop Desmond Tutu, who had pinned the apartheid label on Israel, the South African chief rabbi Warren Goldstein wrote to him saying, "Unlike the apartheid policies of the former South Africa, Israel has no Population Registration Act, no Group Areas Act, no Mixed Marriages and Immorality Act, no Separate Representations of Voters Act, no Separate Amenities Act, no pass laws or any of the myriad apartheid laws. To the contrary, Israel, inside the Green Line, is a vibrant liberal democracy and accords full political, religious, and other human rights to all its peoples, including its more than 1 million Arab citizens, many of whom hold positions of authority, including that of cabinet minister, member of parliament, and judge at every level, including that of the Supreme Court. All citizens vote on the same roll in regular multi-party elections. There are Arab parties and Arab members of other parties in Israel's parliament. Arabs and Jews share all public facilities, including hospitals and malls, buses, cinemas, and parks, universities, and cultural venues. We need to remind our African-American partners in our shared struggle for justice in America of the falsehood of the charges against Israel. At the same time, we have to acknowledge to ourselves and to them that within the Green Line, Palestinian-Israeli citizens do not yet share the same benefits and rights that Israeli-Jewish citizens enjoy, such as equal access to government funds and services, and the right to live anywhere in the state of Israel. The Prime Minister and President of Israel are both committed to righting that inequity. For those Palestinians living in the West Bank, their fight is very different from that of Israeli Palestinian citizens. Theirs is and has always been one against occupation. We Jews may not like that claim, but it's a legitimate one, born of a century of neglect by Arab and world powers who callously use the local Arab population as game pieces on a shifting board of changing geopolitical aims. We're coming up on the 50-year anniversary of the Six-Day War, the reunification of Jerusalem, and the beginning of the West Bank occupation. There's no doubt that keeping residents in occupation has had a corrupting moral influence on them, on Israeli troops who served in the West Bank, and upon Israel as a whole. 50 years ago, soon after the 67 war ended, with Israel's remarkable victory and conquest of massive amounts of Arab territory, retired Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion said to government leaders of his own Labor Party, "Return the occupied territory immediately. Even if no one wants it back, return it." The foundational Zionist dream did not envision the Jewish people becoming military occupiers, nor did the founding generation anticipate the corrosive effects that occupation would have both upon the Arabs and the Jews. That's the true history. Why does the Movement for Black Lives Forum ignore it? Why do they support the boycott, divestiture, and sanctions, BDS movement against Israel? And what do we Jews do about it, even as we fight against racial injustice in this country? A few words about BDS and who is behind it are necessary to get clarity about who they are and what they are demanding. I especially want our college students and millennials here to listen carefully. If you know young people away at college or living in other cities, please send my remarks to them. This sermon will be posted on our website next week. BDS is not what it seems. Though one can make a claim that boycotts, divestiture, and sanctions is a legitimate nonviolent protest against injustice as it was used against the totally corrupt apartheid South African regime, the BDS movement against Israel was founded by the Palestine Solidarity Movement, the goal of which is simple: the delegitimization and elimination of the State of Israel. BDS is not a protest against Israel's occupation of the West Bank since 1967. It's a protest against the very existence and legitimacy of the State of Israel that was established in 1948. BDS promotes the view that Israel is an immoral state and based in foreign colonialism, that there's no historical or archaeological evidence ever of a Jewish presence in the land going back to antiquity, nor is there justification for a Jewish state in that land today. BDS claims that Palestine belongs only and entirely to Palestinian Muslim Arabs. BDS preys upon the insecurities and ignorance of young Jewish people away at college and exploits the weakness of their Jewish identity. In fairness to the Movement for Black Lives platform, it focuses overwhelmingly on ending institutionalized racism in America. Many African Americans who support the platform are unaware of these few offensive lines in this 40,000-word document that describes Israel as a genocidal and apartheid state. Some, however, who are aware of it have oddly and unilaterally redefined the word genocide to justify use of the term related to Israel, and certainly not in the way we Jews understand the word, or in the way the Armenians, Ugandans, Bosnians, Rwandans, Iraqi, and Syrian Yazidis understand the term. For us and these peoples, genocide is the attempt to wipe out through murder an entire people along with their culture. That's what the Nazis attempted to do to us, and what was attempted against all the other peoples that I mentioned. Every dictionary defines genocide this way, but not BLM. Some in the Black Lives Movement understand genocide as what's happening to a weak Palestinian people at the hands of a powerful state of Israel. BLM asks why it isn't genocide when water available to Palestinians is unclean, when their homes are demolished by Israeli bulldozers, when there's such a wide disparity between Israeli and Palestinian education and healthcare. Never mind that Israel has set up an underground clinic on the Israeli side of the Syrian border to treat Syrian refugees injured in that horrific war, and that every Israeli hospital treats Jews and Palestinians alike. This is, by the way, is an amazing thing to see. An hour spent as by an objective observer in any Israeli hospital is enough for them to realize that the comparison between Israel and apartheid is simply ludicrous. Granted, BLM doesn't associate the term genocide vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with gas chambers. It does, however, equate the shooting of blacks by police in America's inner cities with Palestinians killed by the Israeli troops in the West Bank, and calls both genocide. What's remarkable is that the Movement for Black Lives Matter platform ignores entirely the incitement to violence that Palestinians take against Israelis. It ignores Palestinian terrorism, Hamas rocket attacks on Israeli civilians, and the threat of a complex web of tunnels running out of Gaza and out of southern Lebanon into Israel that have been constructed with a small fortune for Arab terrorists to infiltrate Israel, kill and kidnap Israelis in the next war. The platform ignores context and history in the Middle East. The BLM authors suggest that though Israel only occupies a few sentences in a very long document, that you can't be pro-Israel and pro-Black Lives Movement. This is a serious challenge for us Jews. Perhaps here is a way for us to find common ground. We Jews see the world very differently than the authors of the Movement for Black Lives Matter platform when it comes to Israel. Whereas many African Americans regard Jews in Israel as very powerful, we Jews, to the contrary, feel vulnerable, despite Israel being the most powerful nation in the Middle East. African Americans feel the same vulnerability in this country. That empathy for each other's history could be an important bridge that brings our two communities together. And so, what ought we Jews to do about the dissonance between the Movement for Black Lives platform and our love and support for Israel? First, we have to continue to engage and re-engage in the fight against racial injustice in this country. We can't do what many American Jewish organizations have done, turn away. We need to pause and reflect and remember that it's our moral duty as Jews to be on the side of the oppressed. We need to re-emphasize our commitment to racial justice, even as we call out anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiment in the African-American community. To be part of the solution also requires us Jews to do our own inner work, to evaluate our own internal biases, to reflect on how we ourselves might hold stereotypical attitudes and expectations of people of color, to recognize that many of us have skin color privilege and advantage in this country, and to accept our responsibility to help dismantle institutional racism. I challenge the African American community to do the same in its attitudes towards us Jews and the state of Israel, to look at their own biases and stereotyping of us, and to learn more about Israel itself, its history, its true history, and its people. The Mishnah teaches that when the shofar is sounded, we fulfill the commandment of Shmia, hearing the call only when we actually can hear the sound, not the echo of the sound. If we're in a pit with a person, for example, who blows the shofar, if you're right there, you fulfill a commandment. But if you are on the edge of the pit, you don't fulfill the commandment. We have to be present in the arena with African Americans and serve as allies in fighting racial injustice to fulfill the mitzvah of hearing and understanding. And when we do that through dialogue and challenge and shared experience, I believe that their perception of Jews and Israel can and will change. The story of Eli and Hannah that we'll soon read in our Haftarah this morning shows that Hannah's suffering was profound. She came to the temple and could only move her lips in prayer. Eli, the high priest, couldn't hear a sound. He represents the non-listening authority that doesn't and can't respond to what's right before him. Empathic listening means showing up. God, the most powerful of all figures in the Hebrew Bible, hears the voice of Hagar, who cries aloud for her suffering child Ishmael and opens her eyes to a well of water, the symbol of salvation that lies before her. In Judaism, the God of power is a lover of the powerless and also the source of their redemption. If we are to emulate God, we too must love those without power and work tirelessly to ensure that our power is shared with them. We Jews tend to see everything, unfortunately, in a self-centered way. We measure everything on the scale of whether it's good or bad for the Jews. Though understandable, this is not always the best approach for us and others. Black Lives Matter really isn't about us as Jews at all, though it's very much about us as Americans. The Reverend William Sloan Coffin, a hero of the civil rights movement, once said that one problem in that movement was that whites competed with blacks about whose suffering was worse. Applying this to ourselves, as Jews, let's not compete with the African American community about our history of suffering and theirs. Let's simply agree that both are horrendous and filled with suffering. Our large Jewish role in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s is real, and we can take pride in what we did then. But we've rested too long on those accomplishments and neglected civil rights and justices today. Our civil rights muscles have atrophied, and we have to change and exercise them anew. The question today is, what have I done lately? What have we done lately? Torah is clear about what we ought to do. It says, Al ta'amod al dam re'echa. Thou shalt not stand idly by while thy neighbor bleeds. As a matter of ethics and law, the Jew who steps aside and refuses to have anything to do with evil, who observes oppression, racism, injustice, violence, anti-Israel and anti-Semitic invective, but doesn't lift a finger in protest, is responsible, even if we aren't directly guilty. Rabbi Jacob Weinstein, a great Reform rabbi and social activist in the mid-20th century, articulated our Jewish mission with power and eloquence. He said, the Jewish people is the permanent underground, the eternal yeast, the perennial Elijah spirit, ever willing to plow the cake of custom, to put rollers under thrones, and give only a day-to-day lease to authority. Anchored to Torah, rooted to God, Israel feels free to dispense with man-made hierarchies. Our biblical prophets proclaimed that message loud and clear. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, correct oppression, defend the orphan, plead for the widow, do justice, love compassion, and walk humbly with your God. Justice, justice shall you pursue, that you may thrive on the land that Adonai your God is giving you. Zion will be redeemed through justice, and those who return to her through acts of righteousness. Let justice roll down as waters and righteousness as a mighty river. Justice is our mission, and compassion our purpose as Jews, to be ordinary people doing extraordinary things, to be activists for the good, to stand in solidarity with the powerless, to act from conscience, and to bring healing to our land. May it be so.